Welcome back to The Politics of Food. This is 88.9 FM in Irvine. You're listening to KUCI. I'm your host, Joy Hout. It's been more than a year since the founder of Dietrich Coffee in Irvine left the chain that bears his name. Now he's back doing what he has always wanted to do. He's making great coffee for a small community. On the line with us today, we have Martin Dietrich. Martin, are you with us?
Good morning. Yes, I am.
How are you this morning?
I'm well, thanks. We've already had a big surge of guests we've been serving since 6 this morning, serving them on their way to work.
I visited your coffee shop a couple of days ago, and I had a great cup of cappuccino, by the way. I'm not advocating anything. We have a nonpartisan show here, but it was a great cup of coffee.
Good. I'm glad you enjoyed that.
With some people, Martin, it's guitars. With other people, it's wine. Tell us why you, Martin Dietrich, have this relationship that you have with coffee.
I suppose for me, it's been a way of life for my family and I for a long time. It's almost genetically ingrained. I was born with it, helplessly. I grew up on the family coffee farm in Antigua, Guatemala, in Central America. So I've been picking coffee on the farm since I was just a little kid. And that naturally gave me some unique perspective and understanding of what it takes to grow great coffee. And later on, as I evolved into and moved to different places, I got acquainted with a coffee house culture, and that was something that really intrigued me, and which is what I then got into and helped be one of the pioneers of in this country.
Now, Dietrich Coffee was the embodiment of this coffee house culture.
Locally, yes. Dietrich Coffee was the first. That was my original creation 23 years ago when I started that, and it became quite the local phenomenon and was part of what put this whole coffee house culture on the lips of everybody and in center stage of our social interactions these days.
All of that being true, you now have your own coffee shop called Kian, and something transpired in those last 23 years. What happened?
Well, a lot of things evolved. The understanding and the science and the craft of creating great coffee evolved tremendously. The social context of coffee houses have evolved immensely. You probably can recall, thinking back 15, 20 years ago, before this whole coffee house phenomenon existed in this country, and now it seems as though it's been around forever.
Mm-hmm.
It's very commonplace, and it's a big staple. Interestingly, a lot of the companies that pioneered it, such as Starbucks and Dietrich Coffee, Pete's Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf, they were the ones that are regarded as the pioneers, you know, 20, 25 years ago, perhaps more. They're now the big national corporate giants, and that leaves an opportunity for a whole new generation of independent coffee houses, and that's what I'm doing, being the consummate entrepreneur and pioneer and frontiersman that I am. I like being on the cutting edge and really doing what's new and unique and not following the pack, but plowing new ground.
And with this spread over the last generation, the blossoming of the coffee culture and the corporatization of it, which has helped, but it's also hindered it. So you also have a backlash among coffee drinkers that so many more people have access to coffee now, but it's sort of, forgive the pun, but it leaves a bad taste in your mouth.
Yeah. Well, as these big, the original pioneers have all grown and increased in size and become national chains, they, you know, oftentimes have lowered their standards and created a lower common denominator so that they could scale out on the massive scale that they now exist at.
Mm-hmm.
And that has taken off some of the fine points of quality, and naturally that leads to that not so favorable taste you have left in your mouth. They're And, of course, at the same time, it's created opportunity for people who can perform at those higher quality levels, such as myself here locally, and you know, I'm not unique in the country.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of this going on, particularly in the Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big backlash to the corporate giants and their mediocrity, and there's a massive support for the local independents, provided, of course, that they do it well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I told you when I asked you to come on this program that I'm not much of a coffee drinker.
I saw you drinking a cup of tea.
I did. Well, I do like the flavor. I like the smell. I like everything about it. But it's not always compatible with my body. But when you start talking about a lot of this nuanced artistic process that you go through when choosing the beans and roasting them, and that's when it starts to get interesting. Can you talk about that for a little bit?
Well, you know, what it all boils down to, as far as I'm concerned, and perhaps boiling is the wrong metaphor to use, but what it comes down to ultimately is taste. It's got to be in the cup, because people are going to follow their taste buds, and if it tastes great, well, that's where they're going. You know, they're still going to the big chain operators because there really is no viable alternative yet, other than what I'm doing here locally. But coffee is largely consumed on the pleasure principle. You know, I get asked from time to time, you know, is it amazing to you that people are plunking $4 down on the counter for a cup of coffee? And I always respond, well, what's amazing to me is that they're plunking $4 down on the counter for a bad cup of coffee, which is what happens most of the time. So, again, for me, it's all about taste and really making sure that it winds up in the cup. And that has a long story in how it gets there.
How does it get in the cup?
Always it starts on the farm, first and foremost. You know, it's got to be quality coffee coming from some of the world's great coffee-growing regions, such as where I grew up, Antigua, Guatemala, which is regarded by those in the know as being one of the best. It's like the Bordeaux of coffee-growing regions. So I grew up not knowing any better, of course. I didn't know any worse either. And there's other great coffee-growing regions in the Americas, such as Costa Rica, and even still Colombia from time to time, even though that's been a little bit overproduced. Of course, in the motherland of coffee, where all great coffee comes from, Ethiopia, some of the world's greatest coffees, you know, that's where coffee is native to and where it originates. And other East African coffees, such as Kenya's, or, you know, perennially one of my favorites. And then you've got some other great coffees coming from the Southeast Asian region of Indonesia, such as the Sumatras and the Javas, in some cases the Sulawesis also.
Now,
so
how old
where coffee starts, on the farm.
How old is our love affair with this drink?
We absolutely have no idea. So there's all kinds of legends that have been created to replace our lack of historical knowledge where coffee comes from, such as the legendary goat herders of Ethiopia. Kaldi is the name we've given that particular goat herder who saw his goats eating these berries off these trees, and who then was enticed to try them himself after having seen allegedly seen his goats frolicking merrily about, and got turned on to coffee himself and then spread the word.
So it's like catnip for people.
Yeah, you know, that's all legend. You know, I'm an anthropologist, actually, by academic background, and of course, I've studied as an anthropologist ancient man finds, and some of the oldest human remains ever found, going back millions of years, are from Ethiopia, which is the motherland of coffee. So I suspect that mankind, as inquisitive as they are, discovered coffee way far back in antiquity. And it is known that some of the earliest uses of coffee in Africa were mixing the coffee beans with animal fat and using it to go on your hunting trips for days on end, and to sustain them. It's kind of like the
ancient
power bar, as it were.
Right. Interesting.
And that's about the depth of understanding we have of its origins. But we do know that it comes from Ethiopia originally.
And that strain that comes from Ethiopia, there you called it Arabica, right?
Yes, all of Arabica coffees grown throughout the world today have their origins in Ethiopia.
And that's not the only kind of bean, though, that we see in our coffee.
No, it's very likely that you'd also see some Robusta. You know, there's two basic varieties of coffee. There's Arabica and Robusta, and it's usually made out that Robustas are the bad guys and Arabicas are the good guys, and that's not necessarily entirely true, because only about 35 or 40% of the world's crop is Robusta, and there's simply not enough Robusta in the world to account for all of the bad coffee. So where is that coming from? The truth is that a lot of the Arabica is very inferior and very bad coffee as well. Mm. So those who may claim that they have great coffee by the merits that they have Arabica coffee really aren't saying much.
So
it could be 100% inferior Arabica, and it's still Arabica, but it's not good coffee.
What would make it bad coffee? How can you take a good bean, an otherwise good bean, and make it bad?
Oh, lots of ways. You could start with the processing down in the mills in the countries where the coffee comes from. You could roast it improperly. You could grind it improperly, brew it improperly. There's there's 1,000 ways to do it wrong. There's perhaps only one or two ways to do it right.
And you spend a lot of time doing it right.
I think so. Naturally, I have a good understanding what it takes to grow great coffee. So I know very well what to look for when buying my raw coffee. And then I roast it on location daily. I spend 2 to 4 hours, 7 days a week, roasting coffee. Incidentally, on a machine built by my brother, mm-hmm. who is renowned to be one of the world's premier coffee roaster manufacturers. That is part of my family heritage as well.
It's a beautiful machine. I've seen it in your shop. It has a nice position right there at the front.
Yeah, I think of it as the hub of the whole operation, you know, because after all, coffee is one of the most complex food substances that we consume. Think of it, let me put it this way. A cup of coffee has about 800 different chemical components compared to a glass of wine, which has merely 600 different chemical components. So coffee is considerably more complex chemically than any other food substance, and the act of roasting the coffee, transforming it from the raw, unusable coffee bean to the more commonly recognized roasted coffee bean that everybody knows, is one of the most intense and extreme chemical transformation of any food substance that we consume. And so to do that properly, you have to know a lot about coffee. think of the act of roasting, or the person doing it, who we call master roasters. They're sort of in by comparison with wine, they're the master vintners, as it were. Mm-hmm. And a vintner, when they're working in the transforming of a grape to a bottle of wine, they've got months and months and perhaps even years sometimes to work with their wine, whereas the master coffee roaster only has about 15 to 20 minutes.
Right, about 15 minutes. That's interesting.
To go through this massive chemical transformation that occurs in the process of roasting coffee. So it's very much a science as much as it is an art, and it's very exacting for that matter. And I do that daily in my coffee house right here for everybody to see, so they can come and watch a craftsman at work.
So what do you do during that 15 minutes? Do you observe, wait, do you taste at different times, or how does that work?
Well, before I start with any lot of coffee, and a lot is anywhere from 160-kilo bag that's 132 pounds to many. A lot would be a quantity of coffee coming from one specific farm or place and from one specific harvest. And what I do is I take samples of that and I roast them up 4, 5, 6 different parameters of time and temperature. And then I cup those. Cupping is trade lingo for tasting. And I cup those and determine which combination of time, roast time and temperature throughout that duration of time gives me the optimal taste for that particular lot of coffee. And then I apply that particular roast profile to the rest of those, to that, all of the coffee of that lot. And each coffee is going to be different and unique based on where it's from, the cultivar that was used, or the plant that it grew on, which variety it was, or sub-variety of Arabica, the chemistry of the coffee itself, the density and the moisture of the coffee bean. It's all going to be different for each particular coffee. And to bring out the optimal flavor potential of each coffee is really the art. And that's where coffee gets into the level of a culinary art, very much like wine.
Mm-hmm. Now, these crops, like any other thing that comes out of the ground, they would be seasonal as well, right?
Oh, yes, very, very much. Just like cherries or peaches in the market, they have their distinct seasons, although a coffee season may last a little longer because it's not quite as perishable in the raw form as what we're talking about here. But they are distinctly seasonal, and you have most of your commercial chain coffee houses providing you the same coffees year in, year out, year round. You've got the same slots on their menu boards all year long and are offering you what they feel is a very consistent and regular offering.
Right.
Yet those coffees don't last all year necessarily. Many my guests who come into my coffee house are repeatedly asking me for an Antigua, thinking that naturally I should have an Antigua Guatemalan coffee because that's where my family had our farm and I grew up. Or others are coming in saying, you know, my favorite coffee in the whole world is a Costa Rican, and why on earth don't you have that? and my response is that the great Antigua coffees or the great Costa Rican coffees are being harvested at this very moment, and it's going to take another 2 to 3 months to mill and let those rest, and it's going to be April or May before they're even exported from the countries where they're grown.
Mm-hmm.
So you won't see those on my shelf, and anybody else who's selling you coffee from Guatemala or Costa Rica right now is selling you a coffee from last year's crop, which we call past crop, and usually described flavor-wise as being baggy. In other words, to us, a baggy flavor is a flavor that tastes like a wet paper bag.
It's an apt description.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that a lot of people's experience of coffee drinking reflects more and more that mass-produced coffee, just the industry of it. It's not necessarily, it's drifted from the original art of coffee making.
It seems to have interesting cycles. You know, originally you had the MJBs and Maxwell House and Hills Brothers and Folgers, and they compromised their quality so intensely that people literally stopped drinking it, and coffee consumption in the U.S. started plummeting precipitously in the late 70s and into the early 80s. And then comes along the advent of the coffee house phenomenon that we talked about earlier in the mid to late 80s, and they for the first time started offering a better quality alternative, and consumption started increasing once more due solely to all of these little coffee house companies that were springing up around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of them have now consolidated and become quite large and then are publicly traded and mm-hmm. and are national chains these days. And now once again, it's the cycle is repeating that they're getting so large that quality isn't everything anymore. They have mm-hmm. a different master, the shareholder, and coffee is being compromised. And not that necessarily consumption is going down. The interest is still high in coffee consumption in this country, and growing for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
But what was being offered years ago is not the same any longer in terms of quality until. You know, now a whole another cycle, another generation, which we call the third wave in our trade, is emerging, and that's the independent coffee house movement.
It has so many effects as this industry blossoms and shrinks and reinvents itself. It affects the way coffee is grown around the world, and it affects international economies and local economies all over the place. You were talking off the air with me about the development of this Robusta strain in Vietnam. That was about 15 years ago, you said?
Yeah, Robusta, is, as you remember, we talked about moments ago as being an inferior coffee, which it is, was encouraged by the International Development Bank to be grown in Vietnam about 15 years ago. At the time, Vietnam didn't even register as a international coffee producer, and what the intent was is to bring Vietnam back into the economic sphere of the globe, and it was all well-intentioned, but they encouraged, unfortunately, the production of some very inferior coffee, and Vietnam is today the world's second largest coffee producer, having literally displaced Colombia from that position. Who is now sitting at number three. Brazil is still the world's largest producer today, but Vietnam is now producing very inferior coffee and flooding the world market with it and driving prices down and literally having put many great coffee growers, small coffee growers around the world out of business by doing so. Because sadly, you know, coffee is by and large thought of as a commodity. You know, it is literally the world's second largest internationally traded commodity in dollar value, second only to oil. And you readily think of a number of things you think would be second in order of importance to mankind, perhaps wheat or corn or mm-hmm. cotton or some other thing, yet coffee holds the number two position, second only to oil.
As you said, coffee is energy.
It is. It's fuel.
In many, many ways.
Yeah.
So
it's an interesting set of priorities.
Well, you know, as you said, there really is no area of consumption. There's nothing that we do, especially as global American consumers, that doesn't have a global consequence. And what you're doing at Key & Coffee, starting over, getting back to this intimate art of bean selection and crafting the flavor, it has a lot in common with some of the tenets of something you may have heard of called the slow food movement.
Yes, yeah.
And we've also talked about seasonality and local consumption. Now, unfortunately, with coffee, however, though, no matter what you do, you can never really buy local. You're still only, you can only choose well and buy fairly. And how has that come into your work?
Yeah, that's an interesting point you bring up, because coffee is produced in the global south, largely because it is a tropical crop and is by and large consumed in the global north, in northern America and Europe for the most part. And but what I do is I have a lot of relationships with small growers throughout the world that I've gotten to know over the last 24 years of my professional career as a coffee buyer. And many of those coffees are fair trade or fairly traded, which I prefer rather than perhaps fair trade certified.
Mm-hmm.
That has some hooks in it.
Yeah.
About 75% of my coffee offerings, my coffee house, are fair trade and organic.
Mm-hmm.
So they're grown both environmentally and socially sustainable.
And what are some of those hooks that you just mentioned?
Well, with fair trade certified, you are paying the fair trade or the certification organization. Both the farmer is paying the fair trade certification organization a premium in order to be certified, and the seller is also paying the organization a cut of the coffee, and their whole point was to eliminate the middleman so that more of the profits go to the coffee grower, but they, in effect, have now become a de facto middleman themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I prefer, you know, I know what the standards of fair trade are and what the philosophy behind it is and what the intent is. And, you know, truthfully, there a lot of the world's great coffees are grown in both a socially and environmentally sustainable manner because you cannot produce quality in any other way. You have to be careful with the environment in order to grow great coffee because it's intimately intertwined with the environmental condition, and you also have to take care of your workers so that they'll take good care of your coffee. It all goes hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
Great coffees are typically not grown under in conditions that are environmentally abusive and abusive to the workers because it just you can't produce great coffee under those conditions.
So your experience now with Kean Coffee, you've been open for about a month, am I correct? 6 weeks?
Well, we're, 5 weeks.
How does your experience now and how you interact with your art every day and the business itself, how does it compare to when you started out 23 years ago?
Yeah, it's very similar, except for that now, of course, people understand what an espresso is and what a cappuccino is. 23, 24 years ago, people had no idea. They would argue vehemently with me that a cappuccino was an alcoholic beverage back then. people just didn't know any better. You know, they'd walk into a bar and they'd see this coffee maker, and the bartender was the only one that knew how to use it and extracted some hot brown caffeinated beverage from it and poured a shot of alcohol into it to make it taste reasonably acceptable. And that was what people thought of as a cappuccino in this country 25 years ago. You know, that's all changed.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, personally, it's an environment where I get to apply my craft, my passion, my art, and use that to serve my local community.
Well, you spend so much time, and you also have a family and obviously a social life, and other people that I've talked to that to produce a great quality product, you have to do that. You have to invest that much time.
Yeah. I find that by really committing yourself deeply to something and exploring it into its innermost depths in the way that I do with coffee and what I do here, it's a venue into the whole rest of the world and the universe, as it were. Because everybody walks into my door,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I have my social life right here. It's not as
right.
though I'm ensconced in some office cubicle somewhere where I never see anybody. My whole neighborhood and community comes into my coffee house every day. So it's and it's a place where everybody else likes to hang out. So it's a lot of fun, for one, and I get to serve my neighbors and my community something that I'm deeply passionate about, and they appreciate that, and it creates this wonderful reciprocal symbiotic relationship, and is deeply fulfilling in that way. You know, I have a personal commitment to this community. I live here, unlike the corporate chains that I compete with, who all like to make claims that they're giving back to the community, to me, somehow, when you have to say you're giving back, almost implies as though you've taken something somewhat more than what you were entitled to begin with, and now you feel bad and you have to give it back. Whereas I'm simply giving. This is my craft, and I'm pleased and proud to serve it.
You're not separating yourself from the community in the first place. You're a part of it, an active part of it.
Very much.
Well, Martin Dietrich, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks. Thanks indeed for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
And good luck with Key and Coffee. I will be back for a cappuccino because now, A, I know what it is. I would be one of those people that you just mentioned that a week ago I didn't know. Well, you know, I could get around in a coffee shop, but it was excellent. And I will be coming back. And thanks again.
Look forward to it. Thanks.